This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Yeah, I was in Florida over the weekend. Great. Well, unfortunately, you can't come in today.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. You're at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Aaron Daly. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Mike, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, Aaron is the COO of Brooklyn Laboratory Charter Schools, and we're going to be talking about a fantastic set of recommendations that they are out with recently about how to do in-person learning during a pandemic, something that they are doing themselves. So we're going to get to that. Also joining us, as always, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Also a pleasure.
Always great to have you, David. You know, we're going to talk about some of your favorite topics here, David. Things like ventilation and how important that is and the logistics. You know, Aaron, we may be in think tank. We mostly do policy. But of course, during this pandemic, suddenly we've been fascinated by these questions of logistics. Like, how the heck can you make this work? And you all are on the ground making it work now. Sounds like you're about, what, 3 weeks into the process? And we want to hear all about that. So let's do that in Ed Reform Update. All right, Aaron. Well, like I said, you've got a set of recommendations out for the field about how to do this in a safe way. I think you call it, see here, public school facilities planning in the era of COVID-19. And again, this comes from your own experience at the Brooklyn Laboratory Charter School in New York City. First of all, I should ask you, just tell us a little bit about the school, and especially since you were there in New York City, I assume that last spring was very difficult for your school community.
Yeah, so Brooklyn Laboratory Charter Schools operates a middle school and a high school. Our middle school is grade 6, 7th, and 8th, high school 9 through 12, serving approximately 900 students this academic year. And, you know, being in the epicenter of the pandemic, we realized a lot of challenges as it relates to educating students. And what we wanted to do for our families will provide meaningful options. And the meaningful option for each individual family is different. A meaningful option for, you know, my personal family, like we're sending our kids to school. My wife and I both have to work. And so our kids are in school brick and mortar. But we have the option to either send them to school or hire someone to do something different. And your option shouldn't be determined based on your zip code. It shouldn't be determined based on how much money you make. It should be because you have the option. It should just be a natural right, right? Families during this time should be able to choose what's right for them. And so we wanted to make sure that we're providing meaningful options to our families.
I was just reminded, we saw an article in Ohio where we do on-the-ground work. You know, a lot of the school districts at the last minute, realizing they needed to provide remote learning options to their families who needed it for health reasons or any reason. But, you know, at the last minute, they sort of tried to find some vendors who could stand up some kind of remote school. And guess what? It's not very good. You know, instead of saying, hey, let's have some of our own teachers teach the remote program and make it feel as much like a real day, you know, some of these kids now are just being asked to just go online and kind of do self-paced stuff. And not surprisingly, the families are like, man, now I'm angry that I chose this approach because my kids aren't getting what they need. Now, let's really dig in, though. I really want to understand, Aaron, about the logistics on how you're keeping kids and educators safe. So in a piece that you all did for us on our Flypaper blog, you talk about 5 lessons. So let's cover as many as we can. The first lesson is to prioritize preventing the spread. And you had a number of specifics where you get into here about masks, about physical distancing, hand hygiene, physical barriers, HVAC adjustments to optimize fresh air, and more, as well as a library of visual icons for the staff and the students. Tell us a little bit about this. How is this working? What does it actually look like in your school?
Yeah, so we could start with one of the biggest things that we did, which was something that we created called the front porch. And so the front porch is a, you know, for lack of a better term, but a fancy scaffold, you know, that's put up against the building that people walk under when there's construction. But what we did was create a really nice looking shelter that would allow for arrival in a safe way. So what we realized is that if we were inviting students to return in the brick and mortar, the line would have been around the corner, down the block, over the Brooklyn Bridge. And so what we had to do was create a socially distanced arrival point. And so what happens at the front porch is that we have symptom checkers who are ensuring that students and staff have their temperature taken at the door. In the outside element where scientists have said that is the safest place to be with mask and protective equipment. And so before staff member or student even get into the building, they've had their temperature checked. And we've screened them for making sure that they haven't traveled to a hot state, that they haven't had COVID-like symptoms, haven't come in contact with someone who is positive. And all of that happens in an outdoor space before people are allowed into the building.
That's great. And Aaron, I am kind of curious, you know, some people have talked about some of those actions as being almost like security theater, you know, like us taking our shoes off when we go through the metal detectors at the airport. I am curious, have you actually screened out some students or staff?
There have been staff members and students that said, yeah, I was in Florida over the weekend. Mm. Great. Well, unfortunately, you can't come in today. and honestly, families have understood. Staff members have understood, right? Our goal is to keep our community safe, right? Yeah. Our staff, our students, their families, especially in an area like New York City that was hit very hard. So we have been able to screen out quite a few individuals who traveled to hot states, and that has been helpful for us so that people understand that we're serious in making sure we're keeping them safe.
And now, what about the HVAC stuff? We have been really curious about the ventilation question. Did you purchase a whole bunch of new air filters? What did you do?
Fortunately enough, our building is recently new and renovated, and our executive director, Eric Tucker, has done a great job with the design. What we did was bring on a vendor who tested the load and balancing and made sure we had the proper air ventilation and circulation. And they did add filters and things like that to ensure the high air quality throughout our space.
Gotcha. And this is something you recommend, that people do need to find a way to test out what is happening with the airflow, right? Because you certainly don't want a situation where you could have somebody who is infected and not only spreads it to the people that is that's in their own room, but could be spreading it throughout the school.
Right. Definitely. And so it's one of the areas that we highly recommend that schools and organizations pay attention to, making sure that there is proper airflow and ventilation throughout their space.
Yeah. And then, of course, the whole point of having kids in these environments is to keep learning. Now, it was very interesting to tell me if this is wrong, but my understanding is you do try to maintain social distancing. So that means you can only put so many kids in a classroom. So you might have half the kids in the classroom, the other half are somewhere else in the building, like in a cafeteria or some other big room where they are on laptops watching what's happening down the hall in the classroom. Is that right?
So for us, it's actually slightly different because we have more students who have chosen to learn remotely, fully remotely. We have enough space to actually have all of the students who want to be on site in the classroom.
Okay.
And so we have no more than 15 students in the classroom, and we've set up classrooms that are set up in a socially distanced way where you have the teacher at the front, the teacher could still rotate through the space. But what's really inexpensive in comparison to some of the other things that people are outlining doing is really about building a culture of mask wearing, building a culture of self-protection and community protection, mm-hmm. understanding that it's not okay to just go up to your friend and give them a high five or give them a hug, building the culture of understanding that the mask, the washing of the hands, the socially distance, that's what's truly going to protect you in our building and outside of our building. And so our first several days of school, we're working to really build that culture in a way that middle school students and high school students understood. Right. You also think about New York being the epicenter of the pandemic for a long time. We have students who were greatly affected by the pandemic. students who have lost loved ones, staff members who have lost loved ones. So this is deeply personal to people. Mm-hmm. And so we had to build a culture to get people to understand why this was important. At the same time, protecting the people and the individuals who experience loss, right? Because if I've experienced a loss due to COVID-19 and you are neglecting to wear your mask, my response could very well be a physical one because I'm emotionally outraged or charged because you don't understand what you're doing or what that action has on me. The thing that we believe is the most important is building that culture of health and hygiene and getting your students and faculty to understand why you're doing these things and make sure you have the supports to put these things in place.
Oh, that's amazing. And you know, because there's been so much sort of skepticism, even cynicism, that it's ever possible to get kids to do social distancing because kids are kids. But what you're saying here is no, if people understand, especially from an emotional level, right? I mean, this is so powerful for people who have actually experienced loss, like you say, that's a whole different ballgame. And you just got to work at it like anything else. Yep. David, what's on your mind?
Well, I guess I'm just curious to know, as someone who's actually been doing this, what the sort of biggest challenge is or the biggest surprise, right? Because we've all been trying to project what it would be like and you can't really know until you try it. And I think that's what's holding up a lot of people is, you know, you need proof points, right? It's not even sure if it is possible until you see someone do it. So I'm just curious to know how it's gone and if there have been any challenges you've overcome and maybe also what's been less challenging than you might have thought.
You know, getting past the first 72 hours. And what I mean by that is when you are doing something that's different than what a lot of organizations and schools are doing in the rest of the country, the fear that staff and families have around being back in a space is something that was a challenge to get through, right? And so when we announced, which is why we strategically planned on having an early start. So on August 19th, we literally had a prep academy for 7 students. And all staff were on site participating. And what we realized is as time moved forward, right, people became more comfortable with being in the building, especially since we had the processes and procedures in place. You know, I've had quite a few staff members who voiced very real concerns about being back in the building. And I ran into one of them for the first time a couple of days ago, because oftentimes I have to limit my movement between certain buildings and between certain parts of the building and certain floors to allow for contact tracing if something was to happen. And so like I can't just go from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2. I have to limit my movement. So if I go to 2, I'm on 2. That's the floor that I was on and that's it. So I'm in 2 and in the office. But you have to be that strategic in order to really keep people safe. But one of the staff members who had very real concerns said to me, you know, Aaron, you've done everything possible for students and staff to be safe. Our concerns are no longer about being in the building. Our concerns are about our commute. Our concerns are about what happens after that, because it's things that we can't control. But as it relates to as soon as someone arrives at the front porch to when they're dismissed out of the building, staff members feel that we've done everything possible to keep them safe. But it's getting past that first 72 hours of fear, getting past that first 72 hours of understanding what it's going to take to pull this off.
That's great, Aaron. One last question for me related to that. You know, you mentioned screening out people that had gone to Florida, you know, for the weekend. Have you talked with families as well as staff about expectations about being safe when they're not at school? I mean, this seems to be the biggest challenge, right? It's all great if you're maintaining a safe environment there, but if the kids are going to big parties on the weekends and, you know, what's that been like?
Yeah, so the expectation for staff, we communicated. It's interesting because especially during holiday times, right? So one thing that we're preparing for is Thanksgiving, right? It's coming up. People want to travel and be with family. And so outlining clear expectations, right? And just telling them what our requirements are. But we can't say as employers, you can't go travel to see grandma in Minnesota. But making sure that they understand that when you return, what that expectation is. Right, you have to produce negative COVID-19 results. You have to, if not, you have to quarantine for 14 days. Right, just making sure that they're clear, but giving people the information so that they're able to make their own informed choice. One thing that we've also been doing, and this was the first time it happened, we have on-site testing biweekly. So every other Friday, we have on-site COVID-19 testing to ensure that staff members have the opportunity to be tested and to make sure that we're continuing to enhance the procedures and processes to keep our community safe.
That's great. That is great. Well, we will leave it there. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, check out, this is from the Brooklyn Laboratory Charter School, Public School Facilities Planning in the Era of COVID-19. You can also find the blog post up on the Flypaper blog, Why We Opened in Person and 5 Lessons About Keeping Our School Community Healthy and Safe. Aaron, COO of Brooklyn Laboratory Charter Schools, really appreciate your time and really appreciate what you're doing for your students and your staff out there. It just sounds incredible, really inspiring. Thank you.
Mike, thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about what we're doing at Brooklyn Lab.
All right, fantastic. Well, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Good to be
back. Adam Tyner, filling in for Amber Northern, which we appreciate. Adam, hope you are doing well. How's that cute little baby of yours?
Sure. Can't put it into words. She's amazing.
Very good. Well, someday when things are, quote, back to normal, maybe you and David can get your cute little babies together. We'll look forward to that. All right, Adam.
Forward to that, too.
It has been quite the week in the nation's political history, but we are going to stay focused on education.
Thank God.
Especially on the crisis that faces us thanks to this awful pandemic. What are you looking at today?
Well, today we have a working paper by a group of Germany and US-based researchers where they try to estimate long-term effects of the school closures that have resulted from the pandemic. The researchers use a model based on a human capital production function. The basic idea is that inputs like investment in education lead to outputs like academic achievement. The model's inputs are time and monetary investments into education made by parents and governments. They estimate that current closures amount to a reduction of 6 months of formal schooling. From parents, investments include everything from academic enrichment to home purchases to college savings accounts. They also model interaction between the government and parental investment. So when there's less government-provided schooling, parents respond by adjusting their own investments in their children, offsetting to some extent the effects of the school closures. That means that, according to their model, parental time inputs rise by 4%, and monetary inputs rise by 5% in response to the school closures. But then, of course, the economic effects of the pandemic also have a negative effect on those parental resources. The model's outputs are children's human capital as they progress through high school and college, where they choose to go to college, their subsequent earnings, and ultimately their overall welfare as adults. We have to stress that these are just estimates based on a lot of assumptions, many of which may turn out to not be exactly right. And the paper should really be thought of more as a thought experiment than as something more definitive. Now to the findings. On average, their model estimates a 3.8% reduction in high school graduations and a 2.7% reduction in college degrees as a result of the school closures. The model also estimates income losses of around 1% in the prime ages of earnings for students who are now 6 years old. The vast majority of those losses, that's 87% of the losses, are directly attributed to the school closures, and the rest is due to parents' worsening economic situation. Of course, these economic and educational shocks do not affect all students equally. The model assumes that these negative effects will be felt most keenly by the youngest children, since older children are believed to have already accumulated more of their human capital. Low-income students also suffer more, both because a greater percentage of their family's educational inputs comes from the government and because their parents have more constraints on how much additional time and money they can realistically muster to offset the losses from schooling. So the educational effects of this pandemic, like the health effects, are not going to hit everyone the same, and we'll probably still be feeling these economic inequalities for decades. And of course, this is all just assuming 6 months of school closures, which we can't be sure of at all.
Whew. Okay, that's depressing. And that last point especially seems important, given that, as you say, this is likely to hit poor kids the hardest. And it is poor kids, at least in big city school systems, that right now seem most likely to be learning from home or not learning from home if they don't have internet access, you know, versus other kids in the suburbs or rural communities who are more likely to be learning in person. Of course, there's poor kids in those areas too, but, you know, it and that we don't know how long this, you know, I mean, I've been assuming for a while now that for a lot of these kids, this year is going to be a total wash also, or at least they're not going to see the inside of a school building. Now, recent days, you know, we've been hearing that New York City is trying, maybe that they're going to actually go back. We're hearing other places are making noises about it. Some of these other big city districts, Miami, we'll see, you know, and we're all hoping and praying that this doesn't come along with a big spike in COVID. Again, even if that spike's not caused by school reopenings, but just happens because of the fall weather or anything else. You know, I can't help but bring up one of my favorite ideas, an idea that was panned by everybody else in education policy last spring when I wrote about it in the Washington Post. What about holding a whole bunch of these kids back, or a more positive way of putting it, giving them an extra year of elementary school? I mean, okay, not everybody K to 12, not even all poor kids K to 12, but these 5-year-olds and these 6-year-olds who, you know, right now are trying to do kindergarten or first grade remotely, maybe, they are the ones this study and other studies find are most at risk. Why not give them more time? That just seems like that investment, expensive though it may be, would be worth it considering what they're facing.
Well, we talk a lot about how grade levels should really, in theory, be based on what level you're at academically, not just your age. And so it makes a lot of sense to try to keep those aligned. And if students are losing a lot of time, to be able to, you know, get them on, you know, get them to continue to learn what they should have learned. I think the main argument against it is that it's stigmatizing. But it wouldn't be stigmatizing in this environment because, you know, many students or almost all students would be basically able to get another year of school. So,
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, how to make it not stigmatizing. And by the way, a whole bunch of parents, both poor and rich, we don't quite know yet how many of each have redshirted their kindergartners this year, which I think makes a ton of sense. They say, I'm not going to have my kindergartner do remote learning. How is that kindergarten? So they've redshirted them. They're going to send them to kindergarten next year when hopefully everybody's back in school. So we're going to punish the parents who did send, quote, send their kids to remote school by pushing them into the first grade. I just, you know, we're already going to have to rethink what this means for these youngest students. And so let's do it in a way that makes sense for them, both in the short term and in the long term, and give them what they need. One more thing, Adam, we add an extra year of elementary school. That won't cost us a cent until these kids, you know, are
right,
you know, much older, right? Because it's really the bill doesn't come due until these kids are in 12th grade instead of already graduated. So buy now, pay later, baby. It's perfect.
It's the American way.
Okay. All right. Hey, thanks so much for covering this study. Another sobering check on what all of this means. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. And that's all the time we do have. So until next week,
I'm Adam Tyner.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.